welcome to the second panel of the Federalist Society Conference on Individual Responsibility and the Law. I'm Bill Kristol, and I'll be moderating this panel. We have getting a little late, but four excellent and terse panelists who will make reasonably brief presentations, have a quick round of comments, and then open it up to the floor for questions and be through by the time on the schedule of 6 o'clock. Let me say one word just about the topic. I gather we have the difficult task of following an excellent panel just now and an excellent luncheon speech by Senator Hatch, but I'm sure this panel is up to following in those footsteps. And on the other hand, we're competing with the distinguished members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, so in that respect, this is not a very tough challenge. It's been a wonderful argument. My boss, I work for the Vice President, who's an advocate of term limitations, and the performance of the senators has really been a terrific advertisement for that over the past week. Some of the senators, of course, not all of them. The general topic of this conference, as you all know, is individual responsibility and the law. I think I don't want to put words in the organizers' mouths, but it seems to me I think all previous Federalist Society conferences have focused on rights or on some particular right to free speech, freedom of religion, etc. And I take it the organizers of the conference want to remind us that with rights come responsibility or responsibilities. A useful reminder and an interesting, I think, focus. I think it's particularly appropriate to have a panel on the family law and individual responsibility for this reason. Just as our nation is based on rights, and therefore responsibility seems to sometimes get short shrift or comes second, something of an afterthought, so in a nation based on individualism or individual rights, the family seems to be have a somewhat tenuous or complicated or difficult position. Somehow we all know that the family is more than merely, I think we would all, most of us would agree, more than merely a contractual arrangement or the sum of the individual parts. And that's why we talk about something like family values. Yet, when you turn to the law and try to embody that, we run up against the fact that we're as committed or really more committed, perhaps, to individual rights. So the tension, in a sense, between the family and the individual, I think in some sense mirrors or is analogous to the tension between rights and responsibility, and the intersection of family law and individual responsibility is, I think, an interesting place to look, to think through some of the difficulties and paradoxes and questions raised by a nation like ours that's dedicated to and based on individual rights. So I think this will be an interesting discussion. Panelists with varying points of view discussing varying aspects of the general topic of family law and individual responsibility. Let me introduce all the panelists very briefly, and then we'll just turn to them in alphabetical order. Professor Elizabeth Fox Genovese is Director of Women's Studies and Professor of History at Emory University, a very distinguished historian. Her most recent work out just a few months ago is Feminism Without Illusion, a Critique of Individualism. Professor Jane Larson teaches law at Northwestern Law School, specializing in legal history and women in the law. Mrs. Phyllis Schlafly, president of the Eagle Forum, herself a lawyer as well as an author, columnist, and many other things besides. Well known to many of you, I'm sure. And Mr. Carl Zinsmeister, an adjunct scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, has written for many publications, Wall Street Journal, Public Interest, et cetera, on issues surrounding the family, including some terrific stuff, in my opinion, on child care and child care policy. Why don't we just go through that in order, and please welcome Professor Elizabeth Fox Genovese.
Thank you. It is a great pleasure to be among you. Historically, our legal tradition has seen a fundamental contradiction between the family and the individual, or to put it differently, has preferred to treat the family as a corporate unit rather than as a collection of isolate individuals. This preference accounted for Blackstone's assertion, by marriage, the husband and the wife are one person in law. That is, the very being or legal existence of the woman is suspended during the marriage, or at least is incorporated and consolidated into that of the husband. By the same token, the children born into a family were expected to fall under the authority of its head. The family, in other words, was taken to constitute a unit with a legal personality that transcended and subsumed the individual rights of its constituent members. The subsumption of individual rights within the family was never complete. Husbands were not legally represented as owning their wives and children, although they were known to sell one or the other from time to time. In principle, our tradition insisted upon the difference between family members and slaves, although early advocates of women's rights were wont to emphasize the similarity, arguing that married women effectively should be viewed as slaves. Instructively, antebellum Southern slaveholders also evoked the similarity between family members and slaves, not to protest the subordination of married women, but to emphasize the humanity of slavery as a social relation. The conjugal or nuclear family of our tradition has always coexisted uneasily with notions of individual right and responsibility. But until recently, the heavy hand of what Locke called the customs of the country obscured the full measure of the conflict. The central issue during the discussion of married women's property rights in New York State during the mid-19th century illuminates this. Traditionalists opposed such rights on the grounds that they would inevitably disrupt Blackstone's vision of the partners to a marriage as embodied in one person, the husband. Advocates of women's rights supported them on the grounds that married women should be indeed be recognized as the separate persons they were and properly equipped to protect themselves against husbands' possible abuse or malfeasance. In the event, reform of married women's property primarily resulted from the efforts of a third group that sought not the independence of women, but to bring greater consistency into the law of property and to bring that law somewhat more in line with the social and economic realities of the developing capitalist market. The debates over the property rights of married women foreshadowed a continuing debate over the rights of women as individuals, women's natural rights. Many of those who favored the persisting subordination of women within families did so because they favored a view of the family as an island of traditional hierarchy within a swirling sea of capitalism and individualism. It is nevertheless instructive to note that many of those who most staunchly supported a traditional concept of the family came to oppose the persistence of slavery, which many of them perceived as both a moral outrage and a fetter on economic development. The issue might be seen as a difference over the appropriate composition of families. The emancipation of the slaves effectively ensured the triumph of a very narrow conception of the family, and, however unintentionally, paved the way for a recognition of the family as little more than a temporarily or contractually union of free individuals. Intuitively, many of us would insist upon the distinction between wives and children, since the first enter into the union voluntarily, whereas the second are born into it and spend many years in a state of physical as well as economic dependence. But our own times are sadly revealing that the tensions between the freedom of individuals grounded in the market and the family as a corporate unit are also affecting the status of children. The questions remain. How should we think about the individual rights and responsibilities of family members? Does the family, legally, constitute something more than the sum of its constituent parts? To insist upon the family as a moral or social unit will not suffice in the absence of a clear and implicitly corporate legal status. The arguments against untoward, however untoward is defined, state interference in family affairs normally assume the existence of an intact family. Here I do not wish to engage such questions as whether parents who are Christian Scientists have the right to deny medical care to a child with leukemia or meningitis, although those arguments do raise important questions. Rather, I wish to raise the question of whether the arguments apply with equal force in the case of divorce or other forms of family disintegration, children born out of wedlock. Are there legal grounds for denying an abused spouse or child recourse against the abuser? Do we not assume that family members have rights as individuals? And if we do, what legal constraints do we place upon their independent relation to the polity and the market? The point at issue is, one, whether family members are held accountable for behaving towards family members as they would be obligated to behave toward any other individual, or two, whether they are held accountable for behaving in certain ways toward other family members because of the special status, legal status, as family members. As a rule, the question has been framed as one of the power of fathers over other family members. Since the 19th century and at an accelerating rate during the 20th, the extreme forms of that power have come under increasing criticism and legal restriction. But the dismantling of paternal power has not led to new conceptions of the family as a corporate unit. Thus, the conception of the family as a group of individuals has followed naturally in the wake of the rejection of the view that the family's corporate identity was invested in the powers of its head. Tellingly, it has also led to arguments that the concept and legal prerogatives of family relations should be extended to different kinds of groups of individuals, i.e. the arguments for families that are not composed of mother, father, and children. It is difficult, if not impossible, to separate the discussion of the family from the discussion of marriage. The movement for women's political and economic equality with men has normally taken women's traditional subordination within the family as a primary target. In attempting to free women from that subordination, supporters of women's rights have, however inadvertently, contributed to destroying the last vestiges of the family's corporate status. But opponents of women's rights and defenders of the family have failed no less woefully in providing a new conception of the family as a corporate unit. Thus, the discussion of women's and children's rights as members of families invariably focus on what the philosopher Elizabeth Wolgast has called wrong rights, their rights as autonomous individuals. It seems to me that a revitalized view of the family requires a new conception of its corporate identity that simultaneously allows for women's full participation as parents and for both parents, binding economic responsibility to their children. If we are to defend the rights of families as a unit, then perhaps we should begin by endowing them with some greater measure of permanence and a more binding mutual responsibility than just another contract. Perhaps parents should be denied the right of divorce until their children have attained majority or are economically self-sufficient. In the case of intolerable marital unhappiness, a man and wife could separate. What in pre-revolutionary France was known as the separation of bed and board, but would not be allowed to remarry or to assume economic responsibility for another family. To be sure, the enforcement of a married couple's binding economic responsibilities to each other and their children would require the cooperation of the federal government, but that is another debate. For the moment, let me conclude by repeating that any serious discussion of families and individual responsibilities must begin with attention to the legal status of the family as an institution, and that a simple return to the power of fathers as heads of families will not serve. Nor, I fear, will invocations of morality serve to counter the solvent power of the market that is eroding families in front of our eyes. Thank you.
As our moderator and first speaker pointed out, the premise of the title of this panel, Individual Rights and Family Responsibility, posits that there exists a tension between increased individual rights for family members, and that this has led to a decline in family responsibility. But I think we have to start by specifying the terms individual rights and family responsibility so that we really know what we're talking about here. For, as Professor Fox Genovese pointed out, it is largely women over the past generations who have demanded legal and social recognition as individuals within the family, and not just as mother and wife. And it is growing numbers of men who in recent decades have financially and emotionally abandoned their families. It is these linked developments, for the most part gender-specific in character, that leads us to the modern observation that families are in crisis. So in my remarks today, I want to approach the question posed for this panel in a slightly reframed form. My query is, how is men's irresponsibility to family causally related to women's assertion of individual rights? It's my contention that the traditional family model was built on the presumption that men could be roped into taking responsibility emotionally and financially for mothers and children only if fathers were granted virtual dominion within the family. Fathers were made small kings in their fiefdoms, with virtually unchecked legal authority over their dependents. For example, under an ancient rule of family law, explained in an 1868 North Carolina case, wife beating was permitted on the ground that, quote, every household has and must have a government of its own, modeled to suit the temper, disposition, and condition of its inmates, and we will not intervene or attempt to control it. Or under the modern rule of family law, still prevailing in many states, we recognize the right of a husband to rape his wife without any legal restriction. As women have demanded justice in the family, that is, legal equality with their male partners, shared responsibility for the work necessary to maintain the family community, and meaningful guarantees of support if they are left alone, the traditional bargain has unraveled. If women have been compelled to trade away their rights as individuals in order to get a man's commitment to family, when women turn around and claim justice within the family, this appears to be a breach of the traditional contract. Women having breached, men apparently feel justified in walking away from the deal, both figuratively and actually. The notion that women must sacrifice their individual rights in a political bargain to gain rights as mothers sounds profoundly illiberal, and I mean that in the sense that the Federalist Society uses the term, not in the way the Kennedys do. That is, it violates the classically liberal vision of free and individuals, free and equal individuals as the foundation of society. But in fact, the gender injustice of the traditional family has impeccable roots in classical liberal theory that can be traced back to Rousseau. In Emile, Rousseau's tract on the education of young people for citizenship, Rousseau argues that if women refuse to take a subordinate role in the family, men in turn will refuse to be fathers at all, because they will no longer be gaining enough of what they expect from family life to have a commitment to it. For women to get their children's fathers to support them, he explains, women must coax men into marriage and then must cater to their needs and take care of them. Recognizing that their dependence and subordination within the marriage relationship is necessary, women should not develop careers or demand any adjustment of family roles, for this causes struggle and threatens family unity. The message is that nothing can effectively make most men share equally the responsibilities of child rearing and child care, the primary focus of the family in our culture. It is either refreshing or grim to note that Rousseau, as well as his modern-day defenders such as Alan Bloom, openly acknowledged that by egalitarian standards, this inequality of women within families is unjust, yet it continues to be defended by Bloom and others as necessary. Feminism has directly challenged this political justification for the traditional family by asking why the family, with its division of labor and the related economic dependency and restricted opportunities that a traditional family offers for most women, should be immune from the same principles of justice that govern all other institutions of society. Further, because women, unlike Rousseau, feel no inherent conflict between their identity as individuals and their identity as parents, have made these claims for family justice in defense of the family and not just in the name of themselves as individual women. For the family is a school of justice, to use philosopher Susan Muller Oken's term. That is, it is in families that children's moral development is centered. In this sense, Oken argues that rather than being one among many co-equal institutions in a just society, a just family is its essential foundation. Justice in the family, then, may be defended as perhaps even more important than justice in any other social institution. Thus, any discussion of family law that begins from the premise that individual rights threaten family responsibility can be true only to the extent that, one, we are willing to remain involved in a deal that allows individuals to make commitment to their families contingent on unjust claims to authority over other family members. And second, we accept the view that justice is somehow incompatible with intimacy, harmony, altruism, generosity, all of the values we seek in our family lives. Families are essential to our society, and policymakers should be profoundly concerned with their well-being. It is in families that we raise children, and it is there that we go to seek the love and companionship that make it possible for us to survive the harshness of our lives. Personal and social well-being demands that we do both of these things well. To balance the claims of individual rights and family responsibility in crafting our family law, however, we need a new vision of the social contract underlying the family. Whatever the imagined practical virtues of a social vision that demands women's subordination as a condition for male involvement in the family, or that posits an inherent conflict between family and justice, such a view imposes too high a cost, both in the ways that it undermines women as full citizens in our society and in the ways that it fundamentally subverts the moral education of our children. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I read the statement of purpose of the Federalist Society and note your principles, and I think it is admirable to have a voice to speak out against the arrogance of the judiciary using its power to impose liberal ideology on the rest of our society. Indeed, your statement of purpose correctly points out the high-handed way that the courts have used power at the expense of individuals' abilities to control our own destiny. A lot of those results have been brought about by lawyers, and it is encouraging to see that there are a lot of lawyers who are speaking out on the other side. But court decisions are reported and written about, and so we do have public debate in many of those areas. There is, however, another instrument of power in our society, which I will address today, which I believe is just as influential in our society as the courts. And this instrument of power has curtailed individuals' rights, abused authority, and violated our Constitution. And it, too, is kept in power by the system, a solid phalanx of tax-paid lawyers who have built an empire where there is no adversary system at all. There is no reporting, there is no public debate, and there is no media coverage. The lawyers who maintain this barricade are so intimidating that only a handful of cases have ever reached the courts, and you don't even really study it when you take a course in family law in law school. So I appreciate this chance today to lift a curtain on what I think is just a great problem in our nation today. The monster in our midst is the public school system. And it has failed in its prescribed function of teaching children reading, writing, and arithmetic. We don't need to belabor that point. We know there are 27 million people who've been through the public schools in the last 20 years and can't read. We know even that Al Shanker said in a speech recently that only 6% of high school seniors can read a newspaper editorial, write a two-page essay, and do a two-step math problem. That means 94% cannot, so we are not talking just about poor and minority children. We are talking about your average schools, and it has nothing to do with the spending of money, because the abuses of power I will talk about occur even more often in the wealthier schools than in the poorer schools. Now, despite this failure to do what the school system was supposed to do, there has been erected an empire in which raw power is used to conduct daily and extensive violations of the First Amendment religious rights of children by teaching children to rely on a pseudo-god instead of the god they have been taught to worship. And by pseudo-god, I mean such creatures of the self-esteem courses as Do So the Dolphin, Pumsy the Dragon, a rabbit on a green pasture, and a wise man living inside of you. The children are taught that they must accept the power of witches and horoscopes and astrology. They are taught that they must accept a code of ethics in total violation of the code of ethics they have been taught in the home. That is a code which denies authority and denies absolute values and teaches the child that he alone can decide whether illicit drugs or premarital sex are okay. It's up to the child. Don't consult your parents or don't look to the law or authority. These violations in the public schools include daily violations of the Fifth Amendment ban against self-incrimination, because minor children are forced to disclose all sorts of things that we would not allow the police department to require arrested suspects to disclose. Children are required to reveal incriminating information about themselves and their families. They are forced to submit to group psychotherapy in the public school classroom conducted by unlicensed psychologists. And what I mean by that is teachers who've had a half-day workshop in how to conduct this counseling in the classroom. They are forced, the children in the classroom, to read materials which the parents consider are pornographic, profane, immoral, and anti-religious. Now, there is no way the American people would put up with any government bureau or any court that forced adults to submit to these types of violations. But these violations are committed on minor children in the public school classroom every day of the year. And you don't hear about it because the media have not chosen to make this a national issue. Let me give you just a couple of hundreds of concrete examples I could give you, and they come from every state in the union, every part of the country. A typical example of the privacy-invading questionnaires children are required to fill out is one that has been given to every public school child in the state of Minnesota. It's a 189-question, one-hour survey. Let me take you through some of its most objectionable features. First, the privacy-invading questions. Are you a religious person? How often do you attend church? How important is church in your lives? Are your parents divorced? Were they ever married? Do you live in a home with people to whom you are not related? Then the questions to alienate the child from his parents. Would you like to see a doctor, nurse, or counselor without your parents knowing about it? Then the depressing questions. Have you ever felt so sad, discouraged, and hopeless, and had so many problems that you wonder if anything is worthwhile? Do you worry about dying soon, being hit by a nuclear bomb, your parents dying, your parents divorcing? Are you worried about losing your mind or memory or having a nervous breakdown? How many times have you tried to kill yourself? Many questions about suicide. Then there are the incriminating questions on drugs. How often do you use cigarettes, beer, wine, hard liquor, marijuana, crack, cocaine? How old were you when you started? Then the questions to get the children to snitch on their parents. Has alcohol or drugs by a family member caused any of you health, job, or legal problems? And they go through the whole list of drugs. Then the questions on explicit sex. How old were you the first time you had sexual intercourse? What kind of birth control do you use and how often? Then detailed questions to test the threshold of homosexual attraction. The schools have no business asking children questions like this. There's a federal law that prohibits this kind of thing without prior written parental consent. The Department of Education won't enforce it. The lawyers are a solid phalanx to defend the public schools and their right to do whatever they want with the child. Then there's the whole area of the psychological counseling and psychotherapy in the classroom. In the early elementary grades, it's usually called the stress classes. They say these kindergartens, first and second graders, have so much stress, no doubt caused by their parents. In the upper grades, they're self-esteem courses. The trendiest thing is to teach self-esteem, of course, instead of reading, writing, and arithmetic. Now, this is where you get a lot of these pseudo-religious courses. If you go through the New Age section of your local bookstore, you'll find out what some of these practices are, and then you'll find that many of them are in the classroom. Such things as the progressive relaxation, the meditation, the guided imagery, the visualization, the centering, all of these exercises commonly associated with the New Age religion. Pretend you're soaring on a fluffy white cloud. Pretend you're breathing through imaginary holes in your feet. Imagine a candle floating in a dark room. Some of them are kind of a self-hypnosis. All of them are objectionable. The counseling is right in the classroom. Now, nobody's objecting to one-on-one counseling of a disturbed child by a professional. That is not what we are talking about. We are talking about classroom courses where they're all treated with this type of psychological treatment or therapy or whatever by people who don't have the slightest idea what they are doing and are not professionally trained to do it. Only one type of this psychological course has made it into the national media, and that is the courses on death and dying. That did have a breakthrough in the national media when ABC television covered it and there was a landmark article in the Atlantic Monthly. The death and dying courses are very morbid and gruesome. They take a lot of the children on trips to the funeral parlor where they let them touch the dead bodies and take them into the embalming labs and into the crematorium. And a lot of children have found this very traumatic. We have several cases of students that committed suicide after being in some of these death and dying courses. Now, what is the reaction of the schools when parents say, we don't like this, we sent our child to school to learn how to read and write and add and subtract. We don't want him worked on like a guinea pig. Well, I'll tell you how the majority of schools react. They say, we've got your child, and we are going to do whatever we want with your child. And your only option is to take your child out and put him in another school. And if you create any trouble for this, we will brand you as right-wing, fundamentalist, extremist, book-burning censors. And we will leak ugly articles to the press about you. And we will treat your child very badly and make him sit in the hall if you don't want him to take one of these classes. And what is the parent to do? The school is defended by a whole battery of tax-paid lawyers who have built up school law that tells the school that you can do whatever you want to with the child, and the parent has no recourse. I hope that there will be some of you who will want to take up the battle and be a champion for the constitutional and legal rights of children in the public school classroom. They have a right to be in the classroom without having their religion and their values and their parents put down by courses and various exercises. They have a right to be there without being made to disclose what is going on inside their family unit. And just as we have established by the court that the atheist has a right to silence everybody else in the classroom from saying a prayer, it seems to me that the rest of the children should have a right to be in the classroom and not have their legal and constitutional rights abused by this type of behavior.
Like Bill and Jane would like to begin by saying I think it's terrific that within this conference on the importance of individual responsibility, the organizers included a panel on the family, because as has been said, individual responsibility and family responsibility are not always the same thing. In fact, I think most of us could agree that the family is the one locale where a non-individualist and sometimes even an anti-individualist logic is most appropriate. Nonetheless, I believe and want to argue today that here, as in other sectors of American society, an ethic of private responsibility will be the best and frequently the only way of lastingly solving our problems. Now, I'm a big believer, along with Hayek and a lot of other people, in the power and the value of spontaneously evolved social institutions, the kinds of institutions that just spring up organically to fill a need without any social engineer ever having gotten involved. And, of course, the traditional nuclear family is a preeminent example of such a spontaneously evolved institution. It sprang up to fill humanity's, probably most urgent imperative of all, which is the need to produce competent offspring who will carry progressive society on into the future. Yet after centuries and centuries of useful service, by the way, in just about every cultural and economic setting that human beings have ever devised, the intact two-parent family is now very suddenly under stress. I think the statistics are quite familiar to you. 27% of all American children today being born without benefit of married parents, 60% of all American children spending some time in a single-parent household during their childhood. These are historically unprecedented developments, and I want to suggest to you that they need to be interpreted not merely as neutral changes in form, as is conventionally done today, but as unambiguous social decay to be vigorously resisted wherever possible. Now, that, of course, is not the current establishment view. The common political attitude and the premise of almost all public policies is that any preference for one family form over another is a kind of prejudice. The influential author Toni Morrison gave a typical, entirely mainline representation of this view when she said recently, quote, "I don't think a female running a house is a problem, a broken family. The little nuclear family is a paradigm that just doesn't work. Why we are hanging on to it, I don't know." Now, I believe so long as this prevails as our official view, and this quite literally is the official view, we're going to have serious domestic problems in this country, so long as that continues to be the official view. Because in addition to its many personal and psychic rewards that I think most of us understand to be the family's most important value, there are, in addition, the traditional two-parent family has, in addition, enormous social utility. And I want to make a fairly practical argument this afternoon about that social utility. As we've said, the main function of families is to acculturate children, to produce a productive and well-adjusted successor generation. Having two parents around instead of one or instead of none is, of course, no guarantee that the child is going to turn out well, but it's a very, very good place to start. And there's lots and lots of evidence for that claim. For instance, take psychological disorders. A recent investigation of more than 17,000 American children found that, quote, young people from single-parent families or step-families were 2 to 3 times more likely to have had emotional or behavioral problems than those who had both of their biological parents present in the home. Incidentally, you can place that particular finding against the backdrop of a tripling of the youth suicide rate over the past 30 years. or consider education. A major study by the National Association of Elementary School Principals found that children from one-parent families were only half as likely to be high academic achievers compared to two-parent counterparts, and were more than half again as likely to be low achievers. One-parent students more frequently require disciplinary action. They are 70% more likely to be suspended or expelled. They are more than twice as likely to drop out of school altogether. Consider income. We know that the income potential of two-parent families is far, far superior to that of single-parent families. And that's why, for instance, single-mother families have a poverty rate after all government transfers of 31%, while the comparable figure for married couple families is 5%. As a determinant of economic standing today, in fact, family status completely overpowers other sorts of indicators like race, education, area of residence. It's really quite a remarkable factor. In fact, those factors that used to be the primary determinants of how much money you made and where you stood in the economic pecking order are now superseded by family status. For another particular point, look at delinquency and crime. 70% of the juveniles now in state reform institutions grew up in single-parent or no-parent families. A similar fraction of adolescent murderers in various studies that I've consulted share that background, roughly three-quarters. The relationship between street gang membership and broken families is so close that one observer has referred to gangs as, quote, the flower on the vine of single-parent life. Now, I'm collecting other research findings on this subject, the sort of the ecology of the single-parent family, and I can tell you that the list goes on and on and on. In terms of the risk of welfare dependency or chemical addiction or the likelihood of early and promiscuous sexual activity by the child, the frequency of intra-family child abuse, even things like the likelihood of serious childhood illness or injury. In all of these cases, decayed or unformed families turn out to be substantially more dangerous places for children to grow up in. And in fact, it can be said that many of the social problems that plague us most deeply today, things like drugs, educational droop, street violence, what have you, are, I believe, less separate issues, really, than shoots off a single root, namely the breakdown of intact traditional families. So we know the intact traditional family is a culturally valuable institution, probably, I think, our single most valuable institution, in truth. We also know that the alternatives are lousy. Efforts to provide substitute acculturation through various public or private agencies, even though they're increasingly popular with policymakers today, have a very poor track record. Whether you look at public school programs, you look at juvenile reformatories, you can look at the top university-run daycare centers. You can look at the collectivized child-rearing experiments in Israel, China, the Soviet Union. I've looked at the best experiences of evacuated children in wartime Britain, for instance, where every effort was made to provide some sort of substitute family-like unit for these children. In all of these cases, the unfortunate fact is that other social institutions have had very, very little success in picking up the pieces where the natural family has failed. No matter what the funding levels or the skills of the staff or the motivation, the clear conclusion of clinicians from Anna Freud to John Bowlby right up to the present is literally, and this is almost a quote in fact, that the most humdrum average family typically does a far better job of rearing its young into well-adjusted and effective citizens than any enlightened group of professionals could in the family's breach. In fact, it's interesting to note that not even that very close nuclear family clone, or at least we're told it's a close clone, the step family, is able to get consistently good results. In studies of health, emotional well-being, academic success, and other factors, children growing up in step families behave, on average, again, there are obviously exceptions to these, but on average, much, much more like the troubled single-parent families I've just described than do children from intact families. So my point, in other words, is that neither substitute families, nor pseudo families, nor family supplements are able to do for society what traditional nuclear families have done as a matter of course for millennia. Now, at the same time I'm telling you there is no substitute for family integrity, I want to say that it's also much too important to take for granted. Time-tested and successful as two-parent child-rearing has been, it is by no means an automatic process. Family-making is hard, as well as rewarding, and it's possible, I fear, for people to just stop trying. That's one of the things I'm writing a book about, in fact. And the other thing to keep in mind is that while the unhappy social effects of family decay are now being seen in all of the modern industrial nations, the extents differ very widely in different places. For instance, I've recently done some comparative research on the Japanese family, and while certain aspects of the Japanese family appear quite foreign and even warped, I would say, by our lights, for instance, fathers in the Japanese families are, in my opinion, pathetically marginalized from family life. Nonetheless, the basic structure of family life in Japan remains quite wholesome. It's astonishing to realize that 95% of all Japanese children today live in married two-parent households. Indeed, even more striking, in about a third of those 95%, there is the additional presence of a grandparent. In other words, these kids are getting tremendous doses of adult caretaking. Only 1% of Japanese births today are illegitimate, versus over a quarter in the United States, as I've said. And Japanese divorce rates are about 1/4 of those in the U.S. And Japan's not alone. I mean, even in Sweden and France and Germany, not exactly medieval countries, the divorce rate is roughly a half of ours. We read a great deal today about Japanese economic and social successes, and generally credit is given to things like their social discipline, and their industrial cooperation, and their low tax rates, and their educational system, and you name it. And those clearly are all important influences. But I personally have become convinced that an even more vital factor, which rarely gets mentioned, is the family structure that I've just described. Japan's powerfully stable and nurturant families, where children can develop into good students and good workers with fewer strains, are the deepest sources, I believe, of their national miracle. In fact, I dare say if you could somehow transplant children from Japan's 95% intact child-centered families into American schoolrooms for one mysterious semester, you might be surprised what a solid educational system we suddenly had in this country. Likewise, American factories and so forth. My point is simply that thanks to the efforts of Japanese parents, the human raw material flowing into their society is of a quality that would make a lot of industrial and social orders look good. Now, obviously, it's not our fate, nor ought it be our aim to ape the Japanese on the home front. But I suggest we would do well to recognize this, that the single most effective thing public policy in this country could do to improve the functioning of our various social systems, again, not to mention to improve human happiness, would be to quit trying to improve pseudo-families or to manufacture ersatz families, and instead go about unambiguously and unabashedly bolstering the real thing, stable two-parent homes. And there are lots and lots of things that would help. I don't really have time to get into a very extensive list here, but public rhetoric would be a good place to start. This is a very commonsensical message. It's one, however, you rarely hear it in other places. You hear it all the time on in the grassroots, on the street. It's like a drumbeat, but there's a rather different interpretation that's presented amongst American elites. Tax policy would be, I think, it could be a centerpiece of ways of changing some of this. Another issue would be there is, I think, fairly broad agreement today that our divorce laws need tinkering with. In administering welfare and public housing and other sorts of public aid, we'd only have to skip back to the standard practices of about 25 years ago to make a great improvement almost immediately. I mean, people forget that when most of our public housing, for instance, was built, those projects did not admit unmarried parents. you know, how rapidly we've moved away from some of these things without even thinking about what we're doing is astonishing to me, really. A legal measure, I think, that would help a lot is passage and enforcement of parental responsibility laws. And these can take many forms and can be effective in all kinds of sectors, everywhere from child support to street crime to education, to basically take parents' responsibilities at face value when you get these egregious cases of minors, you know, throwing the furniture out of the public housing project or you know, pillaging or you know, terrorizing other students in school, but the parent of that minor is considered to have partial obligation for the minor's behavior, that sort of thing. Obviously, there's going to be howls of agony from the various liberationists of the left against such a program. But, you know, this is kind of an unusual situation for non-left people in that it would be enacted on behalf of what is currently our most socially oppressed group, American children. And that means there is justice on our side if you have the nerve to press on. And the other thing I want to acknowledge is that resistance to any family-bolstering agenda will also come from some libertarians on the right. I've heard a rumor that there are some libertarians in the Federalist Society. And I'd like to suggest that in certain areas, like drug babies, like the judicial removal of delinquent children from toxic home environments, there are cases where we're just going to have to bite the bullet. And I think the logical and moral key to such cases is to think of a process under which we take seriously the social contracts that people enter into with each other. I mean social contracts in sort of general sense, not in Professor Larson's sense. And take these contracts seriously, and when a contract is broken, a private contract between so consenting adults, if you will, when it's broken against the central interests of a vulnerable party, and particularly when that vulnerable party is a minor child, authorities ought to be more willing to enforce a sanction. I think we've been much too interested of late in making state compensations for private delinquencies, and too little interested in holding the original parties to their own terms. In the future, I would suggest our family policies should rigorously avoid replacing absent responsible parties. All you do then is bail them out. Instead, I think we ought to concentrate on making irresponsibility more unattractive. Now, let me just close by admitting that even orchestrated on these, you know, fairly palatable social contract grounds, there will sometimes be tough cases where a family-based social policy will require some constraints. I hope most of them voluntary, but not all of them voluntary, on popular adult liberties. And I would justify that by pointing out several things. One is that this program is based on the expectation that parents can plan their own lives and will do the right thing, and there is no intrusion until we find out that that's not true. The second thing I would point out is that societal intrusions on private decision-making are to be preferred when they come early in the process than when they come later. And, you know, I think the way we've kind of handled these things currently is to put a policeman on every third corner to deal with the sequels instead of trying to intervene earlier. If you're interested in maximizing liberty, I would much prefer to countenance a small measure of nanny state things that tries to prevent the social disorder to getting to the point where you really have to have, again, as I say, almost robocops everywhere, when you're really looking at serious liberty suspending measures. And the third thing I would point out is simply the stakes. You know, families are literally the atomic particles of a society. Not individuals, but families are the atomic particle of a society. The health of a culture directly reflects, or soon will, the health of its families. So the news I bring you is, I think, sobering, but with hopeful possibilities. And I would sum it up this way. It is individually responsible parents in millions of private, you know, retail choices who will be the decision makers that decide the wholesale fate of American society for the next generation and beyond. Thank you.
features of all Federalist Society conferences is learned law professors with cases tripping off their tongue, you know, three or four in a sentence, with, of course, no annotation of these cases, because that would be vulgar and would imply that not everyone in the audience doesn't know all these the holdings, concurring opinions, and dissents, and all of these fascinating, you know, Ninth Circuit cases from 1946. And secondly, this was a wonderful panel to have in Washington, in D.C., because those of us who work here know that everything in Washington, D.C. is full of answers to questions and solutions to problems, whereas these papers, I think, in each case really perhaps raised as many questions and open issues as they presume to offer answers or solve problems. And since, in fact, life in the world is there are more problems and questions in the world than there are answers and solutions, these papers were, I think, truer to life than much that goes on here in Washington. I thought they were really terrific papers and very condensed. And I would just let me make one point that struck me that I think is common to all of them, and that is this: that in thinking about family law and individual responsibility, each of the panelists, in his or her own way, seemed to end up focusing on children, and as children, as somehow the focus for resolving the tensions between individual rights and the well-being of families, which is striking, because children were not always the focus of families, and indeed I would say to the contrary, they have never been the focus of families. Families for ages were patriarchal. I mean, elders were much more important than children, and obligations to elders certainly swamped any sense, I think, of obligations to children. Children had very few legal rights, and not that many sort of not that high status, perhaps, leaving aside legal rights. And then, of course, in the bourgeois family, or the nuclear family, seems to be characterized above all by the relationship between the two principals, the parents, the mother and the father, the husband and wife, more than by the, you know, any obligation to children. And I was struck that each, as I say, of the panelists in different ways seemed to find somehow the solution, or a solution is too strong, but at least a step away forward from our current problems, in emphasizing, in Betsy Fox Genovese's case, the economic obligation, or the general obligation of parents, in this case presumably equal parents, to their children, an obligation that would carry to a sufficient degree that it would, you know, in some serious ways impinge on the liberties of these individual parents in terms of divorce law, for example. Jane Larson, I think similarly, by emphasizing the extent to which the family is a school of justice, I presume the children are the students in the school, emphasized in some sense the extent to which the family would be shaped. One has to judge the family by its effects, perhaps on the children. Phyllis Schlafly, of course, made an explicit appeal for you all, for those of you who are lawyers, to champion the legal rights of children in public school classrooms as a way of, I suppose, strengthening the family against institutions outside the family that presume upon its prerogatives. And Carl Zinsmeister gave a defense of the two-parent family explicitly in terms, not in terms that it's somehow ordained by nature or by God or by natural law, that now famous concept that Joe Biden is such an expert on. But indeed, the two-parent family is justified by its social utility, really, in terms of children. So I don't know quite what to do with this observation, but I was struck that all four panelists in different ways ended up by focusing on children. And why don't I simply ask each of you in the same order to make brief comments, elaborating or responding, or to other panelists, or to me, or simply to your own remarks. And then we'll throw it open to the first for a question and answer period. I will just excuse myself for a minute.
I'd like to take up very briefly some of what I think is implied in Carl Zinsmeister's remarks, and because I think it's quite clear, I do not qualify as a liberationist, but I think there was a little bit of sleight of hand which worries me because I'm sympathetic to his position and I think the issues are deadly serious for all of us. The Japanese family works extremely well because their executives earn less than half and probably less than a quarter of what our executives earn. Their workers earn enough that women do not have to work and can focus on raising children. My point is to draw attention to the relation between the social and economic structure and the family. It is a chicken and an egg phenomenon, and we really are looking at a world in which our need for consumption to support our economy contributes to the unraveling of the family, and I wouldn't beg that question if I were you. The second issue I'd like to raise, again, although I have tremendous sympathy for aspects of his position, is, I'm afraid, another sleight of hand where things like daycare are concerned, because daycare is not the same thing as a step family. Obviously, intact nuclear families work the best for raising children. The statistic he didn't give you is that our society is 4 to 23 times more violent than any other industrial society. It is a society that allows more babies to die than any other industrial society. We desperately need stronger nuclear families, but they cannot operate in isolation. France and Sweden provide daycare in a variety of forms, not like the post office, in conjunction with tax benefits and medical help to permit families to exist where women combine work with caring for children. In other words, again, the complexity of the issues involved strike me as the utmost importance.
I, too, was very struck, in a way, by the congruence of views among all the panelists that the family is a matter of social concern, that the notion that the family exists in privacy, separated from the world of public judgment and public support in various fashions, including the law, was pretty much rejected by everyone who spoke here today. I think we all recognize that the family provides absolutely irreplaceable social functions, both in the raising of children, as Bill Kristol pointed out, but also because it is fundamental to human well-being and happiness, that we get and give love and companionship, and that we do so in these very intimate communities that we form. In that sense, I guess I would have to retreat a little bit from Carl Zinnmeister's assertion that private responsibility is the solution to the family law problems, because society must support the family in a whole variety of ways, and our recognition that we value this thing is not a prescription to take our hands off of it. And that, to me, is the mistake of liberalism in the way Kennedy uses it, that we should somehow shield the family entirely behind a veil of non-scrutiny, that we should never intervene to both provide support to the family and adjust its relationships at times when they become dangerously disordered. Privacy is one of the social policy tools we can give to families to support their functions in various ways. That is, we can say that we should leave some things to people themselves. But that is a social policy choice. It's not the necessary beginning from which we start in thinking about the ways that we as a society should deal with families. I myself would tend to define family in a somewhat broader way than Carl Zinnmeister would. I think it's a fallacy to think that the intact two-parent nuclear family is somehow a fact of nature or an essential biological
organic institution or whatever the term was that he used to describe it. That is, that people throughout history and across cultures have lived in a whole variety of family relationships, and that, in fact, extended families may be more common throughout history than the isolated two-parent family might be, although that is the preeminent form within our most recent history and our particular culture. But I think that we should be open to both the remnants of other family forms that persist in many of the diverse communities that make up this country, and that we should be open to people forming family relationships in a whole variety of ways, because it's the social utility of families that we all recognize, not that there is any one proper form for them to take, that it's the responsibility and community that the family creates that is its most important function as a matter of social value. I would also just comment in passing that it's very hard for me to imagine then, as a matter of social policy, how libertarians would find themselves on the side of children if they decide to pursue a policy, for example, of excluding a single mother who has already been abandoned by the other parent in this relationship from public housing benefits. I think we have to get real when we talk about what to do about family policy. That is, we have to be compassionate with the social consequences that will result from policies like that. That is, we shouldn't impoverish and punish children or parents left alone to raise children in difficult circumstances, that our policies should clearly be focused on generating incentives for family formation, not punishing people who have failed in some sense or another to maintain a model form of family. But on the other hand, I really am on his side when he suggests that we aggressively pursue parental responsibility laws. I think that's a very important policy goal for family law. That is, we have to make real the responsibilities people have as parents to their children.
I want to clarify one point, and that is, yes, parental responsibility, and one of the great parental rights and responsibilities is to be the primary educator of your children. And so my presentation was not in terms of having some children's advocate out here, but it is respect for the family to exercise that kind of supervision and control over the education of the children. Now, I would not want you to think, as a result of our moderator's kind and generous words to everybody, that there isn't any disagreement up here. I have to add a little controversy to this panel. I do think it is really sad that women on the college campuses today continue to propagate this idea that the status of a wife is that of a slave, that is comparable to the way blacks were treated in this country, that it is based on English law, which is a suppression of the woman in favor of the husband. And many young women are led to believe that this is something that exists today or that even in the recent past. Now, the British property laws were based for the primary purpose of primogeniture. It was not based on suppressing women. And the whole relationships of a couple of hundred years ago really don't have much relevance to this country. When Alexis de Tocqueville traveled this country, he said that he attributed the greatness of America primarily to the superiority of our women. And this notion that women have been kept in this subservient, enslaved role, I just think is extremely unfortunate. And we need to remember that the big mama of women's liberation of our time, Simone de Beauvoir, called marriage an obscene bourgeois institution. And you simply have to come to grips with where feminism is coming from. It is an attack on marriage, and it is an attack on the family. And that is why Carl Zinsmeister's remarks were so apt and so important. Now, I was really happy to see Professor Fox Genovese's remarks about divorce. I did talk a lot about the Constitution and the laws that relate to education, but most of the other remarks were merely kind of social commentary. But the one law that is relevant in this is the change in the divorce laws. This dramatic change that started in California in 1969 and swept across our country and has had devastating effect. And I hope we can work out some kind of cooperation to change the divorce laws of this country. Even people who were very strong advocates of these easy divorce laws now see the devastation that it has brought. And that is a legal matter, and I think it has had a tremendous impact on this country. And I would hope we could work together to remedy that for the sake of the family.
I guess the best way for me to use my time is to answer some of the I think useful questions that have been asked about my own presentation. As far as this is interesting. This was about the Japanese family being a particularistic institution supported by a weird infrastructure that is. I've just spent the all basically this summer reading all kinds of stuff that's pretty far afield and is directly relevant, but I got interested in it, so I just kept going. A lot of anthropological stuff, a lot of primates studies, a lot of sociobiology about families. And, the one of the things I want to just insist on today is that this popular, it's actually not that popular. It's more like in kind of universities and in feminist theory and in other sort of prominent places, there's this notion that the nuclear family, as we've recently known, is this historical rarity, this kind of odd thing that kind of flipped onto the surface and it's flipping away and now we're back in the normal state of things. Simply not the case. I have been struck by the fact how unvaried families have been over time and over place. It's really quite remarkable. You look at people who wear animal skins and gather nuts and berries, as to how they've organized their lives compared to people who communicate by computers and over telephone lines. It's just astonishing how similarly they have organized their domestic affairs, again, both by time and by place. There are, of course, the prominent exceptions, but the anthropological, sort of the classic cases where we have a matriarchy, or in this particular case you have something else, are almost, they are extremely non-numerous, let us say. The nuclear family is, in fact, and this is not my own opinion, this is something that is pretty well been concluded by ethologists and other family scholars, is that it's pretty much been a given since the development, since we came down from the trees, and in fact had a lot to do with us coming down from the trees. And it has not changed as much as we might think until very recently. And the aberration, the oddball, the really thing that hits you in between the eyes is the current pattern and not the bourgeois family. As far as the importance of economic factors and the consumption, which Professor Fox and Basie mentions, I think it's a very useful thing. I obviously can't get into everything. It's something I have to share completely. I think the one of the real enemies of, or one of the real problems that has been driving some of our family decay of late is, in fact, economic-based. And in the current fashion, it's sort of too much of a good thing and rather than too little of a good thing. I think consumerist materialism has definitely had something to do with some of the unhappy trends I've described. I'm going to devote a lot of time and attention to that particular issue in my book. The best single description I can suggest to anyone who wants to really hear that argument is Christopher Lash in the first issue of the magazine Tikkun, just to prove I read liberal magazines too. He had a wonderful piece about some of the problems that families face today. And he dwells very much on the consumerism, materialism gone awry as one of the problems, is an argument I have to share very much. This idea that, the argument about context, too, is clearly important. I, for instance, believe that it is much harder, and I'm not just using this as a rhetorical device, which is conventionally used, in a very literal sense, it is much harder to be a parent today than it was for the previous generation, for a whole variety of reasons. You can't just assume the public school nearby is good. You can't assume grandma's going to be nearby to hand out to help out. You can't let your kids run out the back door and say, come back at dinner time like I was raised today. Certainly not if you live in Washington, D.C. anyway. It's an exhausting, frequently unsupported, unsocially supported undertaking today, and I'll freely grant that. However, this idea that the way to counteract that is that political programs are Swedish style or French style state programs is, I think, absolutely wrong. It's something I really, if I could make one point today, would be that this is a cultural problem. This is not a political problem. It is a cultural problem. It has to do with personalized. This is why I talked about private and personal and, you know, individual, and this, those words cropped up so much. I think, and there's a positive aspect to this. I mean, another area I disagree, I think, with some of my critics. I don't think this is as complicated, this enormously complicated issue as we'd like to have it. But I think it's a remarkably simple issue, in fact. And it could be solved rather simply, quite literally, by changing our minds. That's about what it would take. If we changed our priorities and reordered our personal lives, most of these things would be able to disappear almost overnight. I, again, want to concede that there's a tremendous amount of social support and social undergirding that's disappeared that needs to be replaced. And I would be happy to offer some specifics if people want to. But basically, ultimately, it's going to boil down to only to individual parents making the right choice. And I happen to believe that for all the things that have been washed away, there have been lots of good things happen. For instance, families today are much, much, much richer than families could ever have dreamed about historically. You know, people with practically no economic means did really remarkable jobs of acculturating their children. Today, we don't have that excuse anymore. So there are compensating advantages in the current situation that make it impossible for us to just say that, parents don't have enough programs to help them out. It's not quite that simple. Just as an aside, anybody who thinks that the Swedish situation is one we ought to emulate, just read David Popenoe's book. He's probably the leading authority in this country. He's a very eminent sociologist, probably leading authority in this country on the Swedish welfare state and its impact on the family. He is by no means a man of the right. He's extremely dismal on the Swedish family trends and their influence, and the influence of government programs upon them. Now, as far as, let me just finish up. I can see Bill wiggling here. this idea of not punishing, I think, is a critical one. It's clear we can't punish people, but I think you just can't have it both ways. I think you have to uphold certain standards at some point. One of the, I don't think you've read Nick Lemon's book about, the great migration of blacks to the north. And one tiny little anecdote, and it really made an effect on me. He talks about one of his central families, who he kind of characterizes in almost novelistic fashion, wanted to get an apartment. It's brand new, very spanking, progressive public housing project. And this was only about 25 years ago. Again, I mean, most of us were alive at that point. Most all of us were alive. This is not ancient history. And there was this rule, in effect at that time, he had to be married. These apartments were not going to be given to unmarried parents. And guess how they solved that problem? They got married that day, and the next day they moved into the apartment. I think a lot of that would happen. I think you obviously have to help, and you have to encourage, and there's a lot of damage been done in the last 25 years, which isn't going to be easily righted. Unfortunately, the easiest solutions have now passed us by because we've gotten so far down the road. But I think at some point you have to say, this is what we believe in, and we're going to stand behind it. Thank you.
We've got a few minutes for some quick questions and quick answers, which the panelists can do seated, so we'll save time. Sir?
I'd like to make one comment. I'm a judge from North Carolina, and I'm unfamiliar with that case that you
like to say.
This is degenerating already. It's unbelievable.
I'm struck by the fact that none of you have mentioned the higher taxes have had on the family, and the fact that the exclusion under our Internal Revenue Code today is just a fraction of what it was a number of years ago. And I think that we must be reminded of the basic premise that the power to tax is the power to destroy, and that the family has been weakened to almost an identical scale as taxes have been going up, both state, local, and federal, on the family. And as this city has grown in numbers of bureaucrats and in country, so has the family and its power diminished. think that a lot of these points regarding school, regarding crime, regarding a lot of our social maladies today would be solved by the incentive of lower taxes.
Do you want to comment on that?
Absolutely.
I don't want to argue for higher taxes. Any Democrats here? No.
Specifically, you can have tax policies that encourage families, independent of lower taxes in general. There are all kinds of ways to shape tax policy to help to strengthen families.
Well, yes, indeed there are. I urge you to support Congressman Frank Wolf's Tax Fairness for Families bill, which will increase the tax exemption for children immediately to $3,500 a year from his present $2,000, and over the next few years up to $7,000, where it ought to be if a child were to be worth the same today as a child was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I have a quick question for Mr. Meister. You hold the Japanese family out as the model, and in many ways describe it in kind of a perfect, idyllic sense. And yet, even as you would want it applied here in this country, how do you deal with the fact that you also talk about the father as, I think you described him as pathetically isolated in the Japanese family? How do you think if the Japanese father would be more integrated, would that have a positive or a negative effect, or how do you account for that?
Well, I neither propose that the Japanese family is a model for us, nor that it's anywhere close to perfect, and that's the whole point of my fatherhood illustration. I merely make the point that it's not inevitable under industrial modern conditions that people become adult-centered as opposed to child-centered. The Japanese home remains profoundly child-centered, and I always argue that it's possible for us to be more child-centered than we are as well. There's nothing inevitable about this sort of modern life that does these things to us. That's one of the reasons I offered that particular example. The Japanese family is very peculiar in a lot of ways, not just recently, but for essentially, as I understand it, since the original Japanese society, that the sort of central social unit in Japan is really the mother-child dyad, as opposed to the husband-wife dyad, like the Western tradition. You know, that's the kind of thing you just simply can't transfer. You know, granted that it's quite different. As far as the role of fathers, though, in the West, I think it's tremendously important. It's one of the areas where we have the most opportunity to get cheap improvement. I mean, if the average father threw 10% more effort and energy and time into the family pot, you'd have a tremendous improvement without much harm in his, you know, particular adult life. You'd have a tremendous improvement in family functioning and in child status. And it's something I would push very hard. You know, I try to do it personally in my own life. I would encourage, you know, us to have measures that encourage that. And nonetheless, I think that we also have to recognize that male roles and female roles in family life are not now and never have been and never will be identical. And that there are always going to be specialized roles for mothers and for fathers, and that we ought not insist that they do the same things, but really that they put in the same amount of effort.
Anyone want to comment? Jane?
I would just say that I think too often when we talk about strong families, we implicitly mean patriarchal families, because our traditional model of family has been precisely that. And I've argued here that we have to reformulate our vision of what makes a strong family, such that women's well-being is not sacrificed to a far greater extent than that of the other parent to the well-being of children. Not that children should be the one to pay the price for this, but that this is a negotiation that must go on between fathers and mothers.
Yeah, I'd just like to add to that, since I fear there may have been some misunderstanding. I was not for one instant suggesting that the role of wife and mother is analogous to that of a slave. I said there were women in the 19th century who used that analogy. But up until very recently, marriage was a plausible career for women in return for devoting themselves to the well-being of families and especially to specializing in the raising of children, they could count on a lifetime of economic support. Since the Second World War, really since the 1920s, but at an accelerating rate since the Second World War, this simply is not true for women. And to ask women to devote themselves to the family is like asking them to play Russian roulette unless you reform divorce and alimony laws, because upon divorce, a man's income rises by 30% and a woman's drops by 70%, and these dysfunctional single parent families and the feminization of poverty, more often than not, are women who simply cannot count on the economic support from a man to help them to raise their children. And you can carry it on. A great deal of sexual abuse in step families is related to women's desperation. They cannot face the world alone, and therefore they do not hold the line the way they should on second husbands who abuse their children.
I hope we will start to have seminars all over the country on how to reform the divorce laws and address this situation. I agree with that approach. The thing I do not agree with is that the American family structure is based on the subservience or inferiority or second-class status or whatever you want to call it of the wife. That is simply not so. There are all kinds of wonderful husbands who just work long hours to support their wives, and this vision of the wife as a kind of a servant class of society is simply not the majority view and should not be told to young women.
So I have one last question.
Yes. Getting back to the position that the judge from the other side of the room mentioned about taxes, and in light of both parents working these days, if there's one solution I don't necessarily propose, but I like to point it out as a point of information, at the with taxes at 28% and Social Security at 15%, clearly, if you add those two numbers up, that's 43%. Maybe we'll be able to support our families simply with one parent working. And I don't necessarily propose that. But in light of that, I'd like to ask Mrs. Schlafly a question about what type of divorce laws would you propose, and how exactly would you refer to that?
Well, I'm not ready to make a statement on that. I just am glad to see that the issue is being opened up for the first time since the easy divorce laws went through. And I think there ought to be seminars and pro and con and different proposals made. I think there are all kinds of ways that this could be approached. I do not have the definitive answer for that, but I'm glad to see that it is starting to be recognized as a problem. I think in the 1970s, when these laws went through, a lot of people thought that easy divorce laws were liberation for women, and it's really a tragedy.
Why don't we, any last comments by any of the panelists? We all agree on that, okay. Let me include just one announcement. The reception immediately following this panel will be in the stateroom down the hall. The banquet will be back in the ballroom, that is to say this room, at 7:30. Tonight, and we will begin again, you all will begin again, at 9 o'clock sharp tomorrow morning with an excellent panel on the death of contract and the rise of tort, moderated by Bob Bork. Judge, let me thank all of our panelists for a terrific panel.